Hello and welcome to The Art of Imagination with Tess from Jagged Edge Arts. Today I'm talking to writer, director, and actor Simon Evans, best known internationally for his hit BBC comedy series Staged, which ran for 3 amazing seasons, starring David Tennant, Michael Sheen, and Simon himself. But he actually has an extensive background in live performance as a theater actor and director. And this is a fact that blows my mind, but he's an accomplished magician as well. In addition to directing a variety of fantastic plays, he co-directed and co-starred in a double bill called The Vanishing Man and The Extinction Event, which was just about the coolest way for him to blend his backgrounds in both fields. He's most recently directed a very successful production of Cyrano starring Adrian Lester at the Royal Shakespeare Company, which people are raving about, so don't be fooled by the ridiculously incompetent version of himself that he plays in Staged, because Simon, real Simon, is so good at what he does, very, very talented, and I'm just thrilled to be speaking with him today. So Simon, thanks so much for this. I'm so glad to have you here.
It's a pleasure. It's lovely to be asked. Thank you.
So I absolutely love Staged. It's such an exceptional show with incredible rewatch value. It's one of those things that I, as I assume a lot of people did, discovered by accident during the pandemic, which was a very strange time. And the first season, we're basically just watching people go insane during quarantine, which has to be one of the most relatable things I've ever seen. And it's done in such a funny way.
Yeah. The irony was that in doing it, I think we staved off our own actual insanity for a little bit.
but then it was
still waiting for us all. As soon as we wrapped the first series, I think we all had our own little breakdown. But we managed to keep it at bay for a couple of months.
Oh, it was brilliant, though.
It was mad. But thank you. Thanks for being kind about it. It was a lovely experience.
It's funny because it's hard for me to find comedies that genuinely make me laugh. Most shows that people find hilarious don't do anything for me. So I'm always really hesitant when it comes to watching comedies because I'm almost bracing myself for a bad experience, you know? But I actually went into Staged not knowing it was a comedy. I just liked David and Michael and I was curious to see what it was about. And my God, I laughed myself to tears halfway through the first episode and immediately thought, this is something really special.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I'm the same as you. I mean, look, it's an acquired taste, isn't it? And everyone finds different things funny.
Right, exactly. But I feel like my humor is broken.
Well, maybe. Hey, look, now's the time for it. Although I've just done Cyrano at the RSC.
Nice.
And that's been a really lovely validation of, oh no, people do still want to laugh and they do still want to cry and they do still want to feel all those things, even if the world doesn't seem like it's offering people that at the moment. Like, the world just feels angry all the time.
It is a rough period in history.
Yeah. It's tough. It's tough to be creative in that and to go, how do you try to connect with people when the world's like this? I mean, Staged was the delight of that whole thing, was I just got to write things that I would find funny and then get David Tennant and Michael Sheen to say it and just giggle away as well.
So that was so great.
As I say, it was a treat.
So many people internationally know you for this, but your background is very much in theater. I know that you were supposed to direct a film, but before that, you were pretty much all theater, right? You didn't really have any background in film specifically.
Yeah, that's right. I love film and had always hoped that life would allow me to dip my toes in those waters. Like, there's some history of theatre directors moving into film. Not so much TV. Nick Heitner, Sam Mendes, obviously the big one, Stephen Daldry. Like, there are people who've done that, and I hope to follow in their footsteps. And that's what was happening before lockdown. A producer, in fact, Finn Glynn, who produced and co-created Staged, reached out to me because he wanted to get a theatre writer to adapt a novel. And I said, well, maybe I could do that for you. Would you let me do that for free? I was so eager to have a go. I said, why don't I do it for free? And if you end up wanting to use it, you can pay me for it. And if you don't, then, you know, at least I've had the exercise of doing that.
That's great.
And he said, fine. And he really liked it. And then the director they had left the project. And so he came to me and said, would I like to direct it? So we were sort of all moving towards that happening before lockdown. And then it all fell apart. But yes, yeah. To answer your question specifically, yes, before that, theater was my job exclusively. And magic was the other.
Yes, thing. I know. I'm going to ask you about that too. But with that film, was that just completely gone after the pandemic hit? You never got to pick it back up?
Yeah, never got to pick it back up. But actually, it sort of led to Staged in a strange route because we were trying to cast a really big actor to play like a small role. It was one of those slightly canny things where you get somebody amazing to come and just do 2 days on your film and it adds the value of the whole thing. And we were struggling to find somebody. And we got some feedback from a couple of agents who said, these actors love the script. They really loved meeting Simon, but the film was going to shoot in Cambodia. They were like, we're just a bit nervous about going to Cambodia with a first-time director and making this movie. And I was like, well, that's not unfair. That's not unreasonable. So when lockdown happened, Finn, again, the producer reached out to me and said, is there anything that we could do during lockdown that somehow would show that you know how to point a camera at people or just know how to work with people of a certain level. And so we started throwing a load of ideas around. And it was his idea, actually. I was supposed to be directing a play, and the artistic director of the theatre had suggested that I do rehearsals by video call for a few days. And I mentioned this to Finn, and Finn was like, that's a great idea. We should do that. So these weird things came together to make Staged happen and bring it out of that primordial soup. So that film is gone. But that film was always only ever going to be, I think, an opportunity for me to move more into TV and film, which Stage did anyway. So right. I don't feel a need to go back to it. I'm more excited about other things.
Yeah, and probably on a bigger level, considering how it took off, because it spoke to so many people during such a weird time.
Yeah, and I could never have dreamed of that, really. And I think there's something in, because we didn't have any time to process it or to work out what it was a real shoot from the hip thing. So it had to come from a very personal experience. And I still maintain that if we'd have had more time, I wonder if it would have been as effective if we'd sort of second-guessed everything and wondered if, is this funny? Maybe it's not. Should it be more this? Should it be more that?
Yeah.
But instead, it was just, we made the pilot, which everyone agreed to make for free. I mean, because everyone was just sort of sitting around doing nothing. So David and Michael were like, we'll film this with the tacit agreement that if it was shit, we would bury it and never talk about it again. And then we watched the pilot having been edited with music and a bit of a grade. And we went, you know what? There's something here. And we showed it to the BBC, and the BBC said, we'll have it, but only if you can get us another 5 episodes in something ridiculous, like a month or 6 weeks, like complete delivery.
And that you hadn't written anything else, right?
No.
Yeah, okay.
No. And so then we've embarked on this insane odyssey of making this thing that quickly, which did involve days when I was watching an edit for episode 2, filming episode 3, writing episode 4, all in the same day. Which was just insane.
That's completely insane.
But again, I feel like it probably worked with people because we were able to be so quick. So it was still, people were just in that experience and living it. And there was David and Michael living it as well and going mad. And I was writing it from a point of view of the experience that I was having at that time. So it all felt like the only way to write something that quickly is to be able to draw on everything that's around you. It seemed to work.
Well, it did work. I feel like at a time where so many people were just sitting and staring at the wall, at least you, even if it was hectic at times, you were keeping busy. You were actually doing something that was interesting and creative.
Yeah. And again, I think because it was such a rush, there was no real time to worry about any of those things that other people were worried about. And this sort of slow, encroaching, monotony, boredom, existential crisis that a lot of people were having. As I say, we got to hold that at arm's length and still feel like we were part of a industry. And I think it certainly kept me sane for a little while there, just to feel like you had value. Because that's the tough thing about our industry, right? We can wax lyrical about how important art is and creativity is, then something like that happens and you go, oh, there's nothing I can do in this situation. There's nothing I can do to be of tangible, measurable value to this horrific situation that is happening around the world. But for a short bit of time with Stage, I mean, we're not helpful in the way that other people are helpful, but maybe we've just made people feel a little bit more connected to something which is tiny in comparison to what other people can do, but did allow me to feel a tiny bit useful for the shortest of times, which was nice in that moment.
That's actually a whole other argument as far as the value of art, because I think that's something that's been going on for a long time, that discussion of, well, is it as important as doing this or that? I'm like, okay, if you imagine everybody just sitting at home with no books, no movies, no music, there's so much value that art does have. So I would say that especially in a time when people are really struggling, there was a lot of mental struggle during that period, people really, really having trouble with the lockdown and with the overall stress of the situation. I think having things like music and television and books was essential. And maybe you're not curing COVID, but you're doing a lot to help people at the same time in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And I think art can have a sort of myriad of values, but there are times when art is a really good challenge to people and is a really good vessel for a form of education. And there's an exciting didacticism to some kind of art, which can go, I'm going to, in a sly narrative way or in some aesthetic way, try to open your eyes to something which is perhaps contrary to the way that you think. And then there are other times when art's purpose is to go, the exact way that you are is fine. And you can be safe in that. And you can feel connected to other people in that. And you're not alone in the way that you feel and respond to the world. And it is nice when art or artists recognize what people need at a certain time. Like when people feel robust, that is the time to be challenging and to be a bit more confrontational with people. Mm-hmm. And when people are at their most vulnerable, maybe that's the time for art to put its arms around you and go, we're all feeling it at the same time. And staged felt like that for a short time. It felt like a lot of people were recognizing something and David and Michael becoming these totemic avatars for people to just see other people go insane about what they're going to cook for that night and go, oh God, look, other people are the same.
Yeah.
And that felt the value at that time. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. I thought it was brilliant just because, you know, you look at how serious that whole, God, I don't even remember how long it lasted now, but it felt endless.
Yeah.
And there was nowhere to go. You're just packed, you know, everybody's stuck inside. So looking at stuff that really made us laugh, it was in the first episode, that scene with the, where they're exchanging the paintings and he's got the, you know, he's like, my pineapple shit. And I just remember, I almost fell off the couch laughing. I was like, this is so funny.
I'm so pleased you responded to that. That was the first bit I remember. I think we shot that first episode slightly out of chronological order. And there was a bit where I was filming myself driving. So I would go out in the car with an iPhone stuck to the window. I mean, it was proper sort of guerrilla stuff. And all the way through this going, is this fucking awful?
Yeah.
Is what we're doing awful? And that was the first scene. I remember filming that. And we'd got this painting done and sent to Michael's house and we were shooting it and David had drawn his own pineapple and obviously I'd written this stuff.
So he did draw his own.
Watching. Yeah, he did his own pineapple and Michael had this stunning portrait and the first time we filmed the first take of that was the first moment I went, oh, this might work. That's funny and they are brilliant in that moment. And they're, I mean, they're brilliant all the way through, but that was one moment where it was the first moment I had of, oh, maybe this will be all right.
Maybe we've got something here.
Yeah, exactly.
So how did you get into the arts? What is your background with theater? Like, how did you get so involved in that?
My parents were dentists. They're still alive, but retired.
Oh, they really are dentists.
Yeah, they really are dentists. Yeah. Like I say, you could only write something that quickly if you're just telling the truth for the most part.
Oh, that's so funny. That's one of my favorite random moments in the third season is you're, I'm a dentist now. I just lost it. Your sister, she's like, I don't think you are though. Seriously, just. Oh God, it was so funny. Anyway, okay, so that's funny.
Well, I'll tell you what, so that is actually my sister. And when we were first trying to develop the idea quickly, I say develop in the sort of 2 days that Finn and I were like, what is this? What are we doing? The idea then was that I would write it and direct it, but that Lucy would play the director.
Oh,
play that,
okay.
That it wouldn't be a Simon character, it would be a Lucy character. And we very quickly realized that they just couldn't be as mean to her right. as they need to be. You know, if some up-and-coming young female director, David and yeah. Michael can't be horrible to her in the way that they can be horrible to me. But it was still so, I mean, I love my sister and I just think she's an incredibly funny person. And so it was lovely to have some bits with her. But to your earlier question, how did I get into it? Yeah, my parents were dentists. They took us to the theatre an awful lot. I enjoyed going to the theatre and I enjoyed musical theatre, but it wasn't a real, oh, I'm going to do this with my life. And then I started a new school and my best friend was the actor in that school. So okay. I would try to be in every play just to hang out with him, even though I would always get the tiny role at the back and he would be, you know, the lead. And so then we went to this new school. He decided he wanted to do GCSE. That's our sort of age 16-year-old exams that you start preparing for at 13. So you choose your courses at 13 to then do your exams at 16. And he wanted to do drama. And just because he was my friend and I wanted to hang out with him, I said, well, I'll do drama too. And had just one of those amazing teachers who, funnily enough, is retiring this year. His name's Jeremy Taylor. And I managed to get him along to the press night of Cyrano that was this week.
Oh, lovely.
And that was a really special moment and brought all of this back and how supportive he was of me. And it was somewhere during that period as well that I got into magic and loved that. And magic became my thing. And so from there, I started asking if I could do magic shows on the school stage and he sort of allowed that. And that just became my head. The idea of just putting on a show became the thing. And those were all magic shows. And then from that, it was, well, if I can put on that kind of a show, maybe I could put on a different one. Then I went to university and I'd played Henry V in a production at school and went, oh, now I want to direct that. And so through that strange route, found myself in a place where I was excited to do stuff on stage. and then went to Cambridge University, where they've got an amazing drama scene. And so got to direct more stuff and develop more things and do more magic shows. And part of my course was on theatre and on drama. And then I left there and moved to London to seek my fortune. But it's funny, isn't it? Even as you remember it now, there sort of was a moment. I went to see an actor called Adrian Lester, who again is now in Cyrano, playing Hamlet in Paris.
Oh, wow.
Peter Brook directed. And I remember watching that and going, this feels really like I've seen other Hamlets and this feels special. And what is that? How has it done that? And how could I do that? And all of those things together. But I still think it was slightly accidental that I found myself doing this and found at times that I really enjoyed it.
So wanting to direct was something that kind of evolved along the way? Or did you go into theater interested in acting and writing and directing and just kind of, I like it all?
No, when I moved to London, it was to be a director. Although when I finished at university, I had the place at a drama school to do a directing course. And I had been offered representation as an actor from quite a good agency in London. And I sought a load of advice and was told by a lot of people that the agent was a really good one and that wasn't an opportunity I should turn down. And that I would learn more about directing by being in shows and by being directed by brilliant directors. So I sort of went, oh, great, then we'll do that. Under the idea, of course, that I would be cast in things immediately.
Right. And,
you know, that advice is only relevant if you get jobs immediately. Yes. And are sort of able to learn from all of those people immediately, which, of course, didn't happen.
No. I mean, rude awakening.
Exactly. I look back now and actually my first year in London was pretty good. I got a job in a TV show and I got a job in a feature film in my first year. But at the time I thought I'm obviously terrible at this and this is not working. So sort of went back to, no, actually what I want to do is direct. There was then a strange thing. I tried to shop a play around a number of small theatres.
I was going to ask you about that because I love that you did that. I think that's exactly what you need to do in this industry too.
Yeah.
So that people know what we're talking about. You took a play that you did not have the rights to and just went around pitching it to a bunch of theatres as if you did have permission.
That's correct. The way you phrase that there makes me sound a bit more maverick than I really am. But I love it. Let's take it as that version. What happened was there was a play that I had read. And like if you read any play, at the front it says, if you want to put this on, here are the people you contact. And this play had that information there. And I was like, so this is obviously, it is possible to get the rights for this. So I started having these conversations with various theatres. And then, and lots of people were very interested in it. And one of them had really engaged. And then I got an email from the people about the rights saying, no, these rights are not available.
Oh, no.
And you go, oh, right, great. Well, because I had to go back to all of those theatres and say, I'm really sorry. This was a mistake. And yes, I mean, no one was mean, but I did think, have I ruined all my chances now? And then there was one theatre, the White Bear Theatre in Kennington, this tiny little room behind a pub, that reached out to me within a couple of days of not getting the rights and said, are you still trying to get that play on? And I said, well, I am, but the rights are not available. And this guy, his name was Michael Kingsbury. At the White Bear, and he said, oh, well, never mind, come in anyway and let's talk about other things. So I went in and we met and we talked about things. And at the end of that meeting, he asked me if I had a lost classic. He said, every year we do a classic play from the 16th, 17th century that people won't know. And the guy who was going to do my one of these has just dropped out. Do you have one of those that you could do? I said, yeah, I know this play called Madness in Valencia, a Lupe de Vega play. And he read it. And then the next day said, yeah, come and do that. It's all a bit of luck. It's all a bit of trying to play several different hands all at the same time.
Yeah.
And always have 1,000 little things in your brain so that as soon as someone goes, it's not that, but what about? You go, well, I'm ready for that as well.
Exactly.
Yeah. That felt like none of this with any purpose. I mean, I remember when Staged happened and I got the chance to have lovely conversations like this or be interviewed. A couple of people attempted to apply some sort of a logic to this career. And go, it's really interesting that you've chosen to do this. And you go, none of this was, what are you talking about? None of this was choice.
No.
This was for a large period of my career until I would say my early mid 30s. It was all, well, what is now? What's next? You know, I need to keep the wolf from the door, or I'm going crazy at home. I need to do something, or this thing that I never thought would happen is happening, or this thing that was definitely going to happen is now not, and finding something else. And
that literally sums up a career in this industry.
Yeah, it does. It does. But then some of us are lucky enough to reach a place where you can start to take the reins a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And Staged was a huge turning point for me in that because of its reach and because of its reception, suddenly more offers were coming my way for more exciting things. And that gives you confidence to start to say no to stuff as well, which is a huge liberation. My God, the first time someone offers you something and you go, God, I can afford in terms of money and time to say no to this. how wonderful is that? What a privilege is that? And then suddenly you can actually start to direct your focus on the things you really want to do. And then life just becomes suddenly better in a really lovely way.
And I love that the end of Stage season one is this exact topic.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
But presumably that was before it actually applied to you.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
You got to play out that scene in your own life.
Yeah, I did. And I'm always at pains to say that I'm nothing like Simon in Staged. You know,
oh God,
like,
I hope not.
I'm nothing like that Weasley and cowardly, I hope. But yeah, there are certain things. And it was a strangely prophetic thing. Like, we decided to make the second series of Staged. And then the day that the second series was coming out, the UK went into lockdown again. And we were like, we could not have predicted this, that at this moment we would be back on. And then I put in it that Michael Sheen was going to play Nye. And I had no idea that he was going to play.
Are you serious?
Nye. Just... Yeah, I had no idea at all. Not a clue. Oh, he never fucking mentioned it as well. It became so, I mean, that was the thing that I was excited about. And when we made the second series, I know I'm jumping around, but when we made the second series, I phoned Finn. I confess I'd had a couple of drinks, but I phoned Finn and said, I've worked out what we can do that for every other kind of television film entertainment is really expensive, we can do really cheaply. And he said, what? And I went, time travel. We can have Michael talking to Michael on a screen. Like, we could film Michael with his hair and beard and film all that side of the conversation. Then at the end of the thing, he could cut that, trim it down, and we could film him then. And we can have Michael talking to Michael and David talking to David. Genius.
So this was a real idea you had.
This was a real idea. Again, as I said, I'd had a couple of drinks and I was like, but this, wouldn't this be great? We can do time travel.
And they shot it down.
Finn didn't shoot it down, but he went, no, we shouldn't do that. But then he phoned me the next day and he said, but there is something about them talking about themselves and it becoming self-referential, which became then how it developed in future series. And I love Kaufman movies. Uh-huh. I love time travel. I love those weird existential things. And the treat of 2 and 3, I think the show became more niche in that, but it became more specific to the kinds of things that I went, oh, I find this fun. And the idea of them being replaced and that there are other people out there who are better at being them than them, I just found that very fun.
It's funny you say that you're nothing like the version of, you know, yourself that you play, or not even a version of yourself. It's just a separate character with your name you play in the show. But sure. I remember watching it with someone and I remember them commenting, he's such a dunce. And I was like, yeah, but in real life, he has to be really competent because he got so many people to participate in the show. And it's such a, you know, he's done such a good job. Like, he has to have it together somehow, even if you can't tell from looking at him on screen.
Yep, I'll take that. I'm nothing like that. But it sort of had to be. And it is acting. It's also, so I wrote at the end of the first episode that Michael Sheen says to the Simon character, he just sort of, I remember the stage director, something like Michael leans into the screen and says, I don't like you, Simon. I find you Weasley. And I, you know, you don't need to act that. Like, Michael Sheen leans into a Zoom screen and just goes, I don't like you. I find you Weasley. And I just sort of go, okay, well, I sort of melt like a, I don't know, bit of stringy cheese. So there was, in a sense, no acting involved. But it was also terrifying, right? Michael and David are exceptional actors. And we were aware to begin with that we wanted to keep the things small. So we didn't want to be pulling in new people. So we go, okay, Simon's going to play the director. And that's frightening. But I hope I know I grew in confidence to the extent that there's an episode in series 3 where I'm the central point of it. And everyone else is coming and going. And although I think he is a dunce and still Weasley in those episodes, I think there's, at least I get to sort of do a bit more.
And I know exactly which one you're talking about. It's Who's Playing Who from season 3, which happens to be one of my top favorite episodes in the entire series.
Oh, mine too.
It seems to me like it had to have been, and again, I know there's a lot of joking in the show about what's scripted versus what's improvised, but it seemed to me just as a viewer that that had to be one of the most heavily scripted episodes with the least amount of improvisation just because of how fast it is. It's like a play. It's like a live performance, you know, and I'm sure you did it in various takes, but it feels like you're all going through it in one single take. And it's just incredible. It's so good. It's so good. It's really one of the best.
Oh, well, thank you. We got to the third series and I was really happy with how we'd finished it at the end of 2, with them actually sort of being in the same place for the first time in the whole show. And that felt like a good place to end. But then there was interest in the third series and Finn and I talked about it. And I said, well, what I would like us to do is to try some new things, which led to the documentary thing and the moving away from Zoom. And one of them, I said, I'd like an episode to appear to be one scene. one take and for it to be a farce, then that would be the thrill of it. And Finn was really in support of that. And there were a couple of moments where I was like, is this working? And he was like, yes, it is. Keep, you know, this is good. I mean, he's so brilliant. And it was, I mean, to answer the question that you didn't ask, the whole thing was mostly scripted. You know, the first series, certainly we had so little time that we couldn't really afford to turn up and go, the scene's sort of about this. Yeah. Let's just wing it. But the caveats to that are, one, that I would be on Zoom calls with David and Michael as we rehearsed things. And there would be invariably throat clearing at the beginning and the end of those things where David and Michael would just chat to each other and I would be scribbling down all the things that they would say. And so the next day they would get their script for the next episode and would go, did I not say this to David yesterday? And I'd be like, yes, you did. Yes, you did. But now I've, you know, done this and pushed it maybe a little bit further than you did. Like, there are various moments in scenes where they get into a back and forth. And then they were just brilliant at taking that and running off. But it was, all the episodes were pretty tightly structured and each scene was tightly scripted. We just then found little moments in it where they would just naturally spin off into some brilliance and those things would always end up in it.
That's fantastic.
But that episode, Who's Playing Who, yes, was very tightly scripted. It was shot in different parts. The funniest part of that is that because of David and Michael's availability at that point, I was in different places when I was filming my bits with all of them. So I ended up having to refilm all of my stuff at the end of that in one room.
So just with nobody to play off?
With nobody to play off.
Oh, man. Oh, but you did. I would never have guessed that because it was so well done.
Well, I'm glad. I mean, I think I had their voices in my ears from their takes. Bless my poor then girlfriend, now wife, who was downstairs listening to me just yapping on to myself in the room upstairs going mad. But that was a really, I was really proud of that one. And again, just trying to be a bit different. And the last episode of series three as well. The lovely thing about theatre is that it's ephemeral and that you make it and it's gone. And that means that it's very special and it's of its moment. And there's something about that live experience that is there and then gone that holds it more in your memory. But it means that it's really hard to gauge whether you're getting better at something, because you can at no point, like I directed Cyrano in that White Bear Theatre 15 years ago, and I'm not able to go back and look at that and go, I hope I'm better now than I was 15 years ago, but I can't look back and compare these two things and see.
Do you not have, like, they don't do archive videos or anything like that?
We don't have archive videos. Really? None of those tiny pub theatre things, no. But the lovely thing was making series three and going back to series one to look at a couple of things. And you can debate whether or not it is more to your taste or not, or whether the nicheness and the existential angle of it is what people want out of it or not. But it is undeniably more confident in series three and is trying to do slightly bigger, madder, sillier things. Every now and again, I watch one and I'm incredibly proud of one. But when you get to that episode that you mentioned, Who's Playing Who, and the end of three, I go, yeah, we're flying now. And that's, it's a lovely thing to be able to compare those and go, oh yeah, look, we all got better at this. It's a nice feeling.
Yeah, I mean, the finale is hilarious. Everything's hilarious. But you do have this great flow to it. And it just, it does feel very fluid. It moves really fast. And
yeah.
Again, with it being the nature of film, obviously, that's not going to be the case when you're actually making it. But the result really does feel that way. And it's so good.
We perhaps get a better sense of it than you would if you were on a film set, because it is still whoever it is on a Zoom screen. So I'm still able to see it as we're doing it the way that an audience will ultimately see it.
Right.
Dan Gage, who edited the first two series, was incredible at helping set the pace of it and the tone of it and a sort of visual language for it. But yes, I hope that it flows and all sort of stitches together. And the benefit of working with, I mean, who was in that last episode? We brought back all our original guys. Adrian Lester, Ben Schwartz, my God. I mean, Adrian Lester, who I'm working with now, who is my Cyrano, who is undoubtedly one of the most charismatic people I know on stage, but I'd never seen him do comedy before. And he just sort of turned up in series one doing his Birmingham accent. And like, these are just amazing performers who can turn up with zero notice with a script they got the day before and do it brilliantly. And it's such a privilege.
Oh, that's so good. So I'm curious, now we're jumping all over the place here. That's what you get for talking to somebody with ADHD. This is what I realized after several years of directing. I completely lack the organizational skills to manage other people and was totally unqualified for the job and that level of responsibility for so many moving parts.
Directing is, it's a management job as much as it is, not as much as it is creative, but a big part of it is just how do you bring this disparate group of people together to form a company to produce one thing. you sort of try to smuggle creativity in amongst all of that.
Yeah. I kind of eventually realized that what works for me is being able to participate in a way that I'm not responsible for anyone else. So like, I love doing production photography because it's me, my camera. I don't have to keep track of people. So I definitely have a lot of admiration for people who have their shit together enough to direct.
Well, yeah, but I get that feeling too. When it's all going well, the fact that you're in charge and you're making it all happen is wonderful. But then you absolutely have moments where it's all going to shit and you go, yes. If I could just go back to checking in on people, making some teas and coffees, doing some small bits around the edge, I would do anything for that right now.
It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
And you really have to be on top of things. And I think, unfortunately, I'm not. But yeah, so jumping back to what you were talking about before with shopping that script around, I think that's such a wonderful thing that you were able to do that and to turn it into something.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people just don't even take that step. I mean, whether or not you had the rights to do it, whether or not you were able to get the rights isn't really the point. I feel like the fact that you took that chance and then you were able to do something else is such a great example of why you need to just kind of go for it.
Yes, I think that's right. And that's very kindly put. This industry is tough and trying to make things happen is difficult. And I think what that requires of people is a sort of nimbleness and a robustness that goes, yes, you just need to make it happen for yourself. And that requires you to be bullish. That requires you to sort of go in and I wouldn't recommend lying, but certainly there's a very famous story of somebody going to a big theater in London. I can't remember who it is, and it's maybe apocryphal, but saying, I've got this A-list actor who wants to do this play at your theater. Can we do it here? And the theater going, yes, if you've got that A-list actor, then we'll let you have it here. At which point this director phoned the A-list actor and said, this theater wants me to do this play, having never spoken to him before, saying, this theater wants me to do this play with you. What do you think? And had sort of given half truths to both and made this thing happen. And I think you just need to try to do it. And that comes with, like, I'm aware that I come from a very fortunate background and that if I had come to London and just fundamentally run out of all money and all resources, I could have gone back home. Like, I'm aware that I'm able to take risks that other people might not have been able to. But I do think anything you can do to allow yourself to be more of a risk taker and to try to, no one else is going to invest in you. No one else is going to believe in you. So you have to believe in yourself and just keep going and always be ready to sidestep slightly to try and move into something, to try and keep yourself focused on something in front of you, but always have like your antennae tuned for, this has just happened over there. Maybe that's a better option. I should accelerate into that. And try to be sensitive to where opportunities are arising. It's tough. I remember being asked to direct a show at the Donmar Warehouse, which is a theatre here in London.
And they film things there, right? Because I know I've seen in theatres here.
Yeah, they film things there. I mean, it's an amazing theatre. It's still probably my favourite theatre in the world. And at that time, I had been invited back to Cambridge University to give a talk to some undergrads. When I had been at Cambridge myself, my director of studies had had a play on at the Donmar that he'd written, and I'd gone to see it and had at that point gone, I really want to work on something at the Donmar. So said to these Cambridge students, I've been out of university for 10 years and it's such a lovely time to come and talk to you because I wanted to direct at the Donmar when I left here. And here I am, I'm about to direct at the Donmar. And so it's a lovely thing to be here. And then one girl in her questions at the end said to me very astutely, if you'd known then that it would have taken you 10 years to get to the Donmar, would you have still wanted to do it? And the question floored me. I was like, God, I have no idea. And maybe part of it is that you don't know how long anything's going to take. And that just sort of keeps us engaged in it more. The other side of that, and I'm sorry, I'm darting around as well, is that...
No, it's totally fine. Look, that's the format here.
Great. Well, you'll tell me when I need to be more focused.
Absolutely.
But like the thing about our industry as well is that everything I've just said comes with the caveat that... unlike almost any other kind of work that I can think of, showbiz, be that as culturally significant as theatre or whatever is at the other end of that scale, offers the promise of an overnight change to your life. Like, it keeps you really pressed up against the glass for a long time because you just don't know that after not acting in anything substantial for years, you might suddenly be plucked out of obscurity and suddenly you're at the Oscars.
Yeah.
Or you can have directed small shows for years, then suddenly one thing catapults you up here. Like, there are so many stories of that thing happening that I think it keeps people doing everything I've just said, and it keeps people trying for a long time. And I confess I've lost a bit of patience for famous actors who stand up and go, just believe in yourself, because I was about to throw it all in and then I got the phone call that offered me this role or this. Because while that is true, it can be a really miserable industry, and it can really take a lot from you. And I think people need to be really honest about that. And I think if people can be realistic with themselves and honest with themselves about, is this still bringing me the joy that it did? And if it still is, then just keep doing it and just keep pushing and keep knocking on every door and trying to reach out to everybody and making all those things happen. But if it's not making you happy anymore, then do something else.
I completely agree. I know so many people who got into this industry and had all these visions of, I'm going to be an award-winning director. I'm going to produce things. I'm going to write things. And then they work so hard, but they work as production assistants. They work as script supervisors and ADs. And there's so much pressure. Yeah. And then you have other people who stepped in and the next day they were in something big, like straight out of drama school, straight out of film school. There is an element of stamina. I agree that you have to kind of keep pushing. But I also think there's luck, there's timing, there's talent combined with all these things. You kind of have to have everything. Like, all the stars have to align. It's impossible to know, right? You just kind of have to do it because you enjoy it and because you want to do it.
Completely. And I think that's the most important thing. And to go, am I happy with what I'm doing now? And it's tough, right? You sort of, you find yourself comparing whatever you do to the entirety of everybody else's achievements.
Right.
And that's a battle that you're always going to lose. But if you can try to be objective about, am I getting some joy from it now? And that can change at different parts of your life. Like, in your 20s, I think just being a part of it is fucking great.
Yeah, right? Yeah, no, exactly.
Especially in London. You know, you're making work, you're sleeping with the wrong people, you're falling in and out of love, things are doing well, things are doing badly. Like, the whole thing is this weird hedonistic vocational adventure. And then you get a bit older and you go, oh, maybe I would like to have a nicer flat, or be able to go away for a weekend or on holiday, or have some disposable income, or marry and have a family, settle down, whatever else. It becomes a different set of priorities. And I think it's really important for people to reflect on it then and go, is this still bringing me the joy that I want it to, or still enabling that life that I want? And if it's not, I wouldn't bet on it changing for you.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
The arts are very unique in that regard. It's not like going into any other profession, and not an easy path.
No.
Hopping back to what brings you joy, you talked about magic. And I love that. That's not something I would have guessed. You did that double bill a little while back.
Yeah.
Vanishing Man and...
And The Extinction Event.
Yes. And that was something that allowed you to incorporate your passion for magic and illusion into the story.
Yeah. I had been a magician I got into magic when I was 13 and spent some time in America when I was 18, making my way from LA to New York doing magic.
Oh, wow.
There, which was an amazing experience. And I met a load of incredible magicians along the way and learned a lot of stuff from them there. And then in my early 20s, got really good, like really good. Won a couple of competitions.
No kidding.
For it, and was like, yeah, okay.
That's
this
so
is good.
Cool.
And it became, even when I wanted to be a director, like, I was putting on my own work. I wasn't making any money from it. So magic became this sort of, I can earn a bit of money in London by doing, posh corporate parties. And that became my bread and butter. And I started doing a thing called Electron Misdirection, which was a standalone little show I would do that was about 45 minutes long, that was about how magic worked and the psychology of it. And a friend of mine who is a writer, a guy called David Owler, who's a very brilliant theatre maker with a really interesting mind on how you can use theatre to engage audiences and different forms of it, saw this lecture on misdirection and said, there's something in this. So he and I sat down and ended up developing a whole story based on magical research and stuff like that, and based on real history, of about magic and its ability to play on your beliefs. Like, the relationship with a magician is a really interesting one, because it is a director, it is a playwright, it is a screenwriter, it's everything. It is someone who says to you, I'm going to lie to you now. But if you just don't worry about that too much, and if you go along with it, I guarantee you'll have an amazing time. You'll have an emotional experience if you just forget that I'm lying and forget that I'm trying to trick you. And the whole thing is just going, let us here agree together that I'm able to do this. And if you believe that, it's going to be amazing, because it'll look like I can. But if you choose to question it, it'll be less effective. And so the play was sort of about that, and was about how people come to believe things. And it was about magic as the ultimate myth of overcoming death. And it used an audience in a really fun way. And the whole show ended up being a magic trick where there was a big twist at the end.
Oh, that's
like,
so
I'm really
cool.
proud of it. So David and I wrote it together and were both in it and co-directed it, co-wrote it, co-starred in it. And we did it in London, then took it to Edinburgh, then did a tour of it. And then we made the Extinction Event as a similar, playing with similar ideas, playing with AI and tried to make something a bit more current. It was interesting. It was slightly less effective than The Vanishing Man, but it was still a really interesting experiment. And we're always talking about if there's something more there. But I think it's interesting you say you wouldn't have seen it in the other stuff. And I think that's probably right, but I sort of see it in everything. Magic's all about little surprises. And I have this growing theory when it comes to performance art of any kind, be that film or TV or theatre, that surprise is one of the most valuable commodities that you have. I don't mean shock. I don't mean jump scares, although they can be fun. But shock brings out cortisol and adrenaline, and we don't want those. But surprise gets all the good stuff. It gets endorphins out of you. Like little, that hasn't quite happened the way that I thought it would. Or I'm being led down this path, and then suddenly something slightly unexpected has happened. That makes us lean in closer and actually sort of gets all those good hormones going. And magic is all surprise. A punchline is a magic trick. A punchline is you think it's something's about to happen, then something different happens and you're unexpected and you're surprised by it.
That's so interesting. I don't think I've ever heard it put that way, but it fits.
I think that. As I say, it's a sort of early theory, but I mean, staging is misdirection, really. And the best magic is a really good story. And all of those things I find invariably when I look at something I've directed, I can go, oh, I realize where I learned how to do it that way. And that was because of a magic trick or something else. But I feel like there's an awful lot of crossover, some really explicit, like The Vanishing Man, some a bit more. Like, I think this production of Cyrano that I've just done is a big old magic trick.
Really?
It's like, yeah, in that people don't quite realize all the little things that are happening to try and get us to a place where an audience is emotionally ready for this big thing to happen at the end that hopefully breaks your heart. But that requires so much sleight of hand in the writing, little deceptions in the way we stage it, and little things that we bring in that you think mean one thing, then mean the other. And those aren't twists, but suddenly at the end, you can go, because of all of that stuff, that scaffold that we put in here, you get to go, ta-da, at the end. And that moment, people go, oh God, now I'm feeling something emotional. Does that make any sense?
Oh, of course it makes sense. That's a really fascinating way of looking at it. Like I said, I've never heard it put that way before, but I love the idea, especially coming from this background you have in magic to define it that way.
Yeah, we're getting there.
For me, that actually brings up a good point. You mentioned the ephemeral nature of theater, how it's here and then it's gone. And that is a really wonderful thing. And one of the magical things about live performance. But what are your feelings about filming these types of shows? Like capturing one performance live in front of a normal audience, like any other night, kind of like a glorified archive recording, and releasing it for people to see. So that if someone isn't able to get there in person to see something like Cyrano or The Vanishing Man or any other production, be it because they're halfway around the world or just can't afford to go, or maybe even didn't hear about it until after the fact, all those people would have some way of seeing it. Maybe not the perfect way, but at least they can experience it in some capacity and it's not lost forever once it's left the stage.
I think two things simultaneously and equally. I think it's a wonderful thing to do because theatre is expensive and people can't come to see it. And I think anything we can do that can make some of these things live a little longer and be able to be enjoyed by wider people. Like, not everyone can come to Stratford-upon-Avon for the RSC. Not everyone can get into London. Not everyone can pay what are now, in some places, silly money for tickets to go and see a show.
I mean, have you been to Broadway recently?
Yeah. I mean, like, that's just, I work in this industry and do reasonably well, and I can't afford to go and see the things that I would like to go and see. And so I think anything that can be done where you can go to your local cinema, and I really like the live ones of those where they film it live and you can go that night to watch them, and at least you then feel like you're part of the collective experience. And on the other end of it, I go theatre. What I think is a shame about some theatre in general is that it is moving to emulate TV and film more and more.
Mm.
Like short scenes, the audience invisible to them. I sometimes see things and go, that's a feature film that you put on stage. And the fact that we are here watching it as an audience is immaterial. Whereas I'm really excited by work that goes, I mean, again, it's the magician in me. I go, we've got 400 people locked in a room for 2.5 hours. What can we do with them? What fun can we have with those people who volunteered to be part of whatever experiment it is that we're doing?
Right.
I think that's hugely enjoyable. And so I think it's a shame that what that is doing, the filming of it, and it is perhaps continuing a trend that I don't love, which is making theatre less live and ritualistic and cathartic. And I think on a really primal level, theatre can do that thing where someone walks on stage and draws a weird circle of sand with their hand and goes, now I'm safe in this circle, I'm going to tell you a story. And we all go, yes, tell us a story. Yes. And that catharsis thing that goes, we all collectively here need to see some Greek hero be cut down and die on stage. We sort of go, yes, we all feel something together. And I'm wary of anything which takes away from that and makes theatre more clinical and distant and removed. So those are the two things I feel. Entirely in contradiction, but at the same time.
I see both sides. But I think, for example, I don't know if you ever saw it. I think it was in 2001, 2002. My favorite play of all time is a show called Metamorphoses by Mary Zimmerman. Did you ever see that?
I didn't know, but I've heard of it.
Oh, it's brilliant. And I went and saw it several times back when Broadway was more affordable. But I saw it several times when it was running at the Circle and Square, and it's just one of the greatest things I've ever seen. And it's stunningly beautiful, like just shocking as far as production design and the stories, and it was great performances. And it's like, on the one hand, you can never replicate the feeling of being there, but I would kill to have a video copy of that. Like, it makes me so sad that there's no way of ever seeing that again.
Yeah.
And I would love for these shows to all just be filmed, not in some big dramatic way, but in a way that just kind of captures the live performance as best it can, and then make it available at some point for people to see who can't get there.
Yeah.
That's something I think the theater world needs to consider. But it's funny because I remember reading an interview you and David Aula gave on The Vanishing Man, where you said, I'm pretty sure it was you who said it, we don't go to the theater to watch sane people talking about normal things.
I think that was me, yeah.
I love that description. Do you think it's easier, given the nature of theater, to take creative risks and get away with doing crazy stuff on stage, to experiment and try new things? Or do you feel that applies equally to film? Because as far as I'm concerned, you can do things on stage that you really wouldn't do in film as a rule. I mean, you can have someone who looks like a completely normal person just move and talk differently, and now the audience believes they're the Elephant Man. Whereas with film, there's a different type of suspension of disbelief, and it's a lot more unforgiving in many ways. So it seems like theater is a better place to just go wild and try new things that are in a lot of ways more daring or out there.
I think it can apply equally to film, but I think then you're in the sort of indie market more, aren't you? I think people come to theater slightly more open-minded.
Yeah.
When I talk about that sort of stuff and to be experimental, what you need to do is you need to make people unfold their arms and relax. Like, you're weaving a dream for them, aren't you? And you're going, in this weird dream that we've made, this is what the logic is in this dream. And if you'll buy into that, then we're going to do something wild with you. It's the magic trick again. The whole trick of it works by early on going, do you buy into these certain set of criteria? And if you do, we're going to have a fucking amazing time. And I think in theatre, it's slightly easier to get people to buy into that different reality. I think film, people go to expecting realism more. Even if we're in a place of sort of absurdity, it's still rooted in the absurdity is a distortion of the normal. Like, there is a normality to return to.
Right.
Whereas theatre just goes, no, we're in an Ionesco play now, and that means that the rules are different, or we're watching Spurt of Blood or whatever. It's like these strange things that allow us to be more subjective and allow us to read into them more and to be less literal. And yeah, that still feels like the purview of theatre more than it does film. I mean, it's harder in that I think that sort of dream that you need to weave or that spell you need to cast it's getting harder to cast that. It's getting harder for people to buy into it. And the more theatre tries to do that and doesn't succeed, the more people go, well, I'm not going to give you my trust again. But yes, fundamentally, I think theatre can still do a thing where in the first 5 minutes, it could go, these are our rules. And an audience will pretty willingly go, great, we'll come with you on that journey, I hope.
Most people who go, I think, have that mindset.
Yeah.
But I do agree that now we're in a world where entertainment has changed so much. And God, YouTube and social media has changed a lot of younger people. I'm sounding old now.
I know, I'm with you. Yeah.
Changed a lot of younger people's view of what entertainment is and what they expect from it. So
yeah, and that stuff that you're talking about does require more of an audience. I've had that speech from people for TV series that I'm writing where they talk about second screening and they go, you're going to need to repeat the plot of this every 15 minutes, just in case those people who are watching this show while also browsing their phone can understand what's going on. And you go, my God, how has anybody going to even attempt to try something different or new? Because different or new does require the attention of the audience and does require a sort of patience from them and focus. And yeah, if we haven't got that, then we're in trouble.
Focus is, I feel, lacking in a lot of people these days.
Very lacking. Very lacking.
It's a little concerning, but
yeah,
we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. When the end of the world comes, we'll all be around fires and people will be telling stories and circles of sand again. So then it'll be fine. Then it'll be fine.
Yeah, we'll kind of await that day. But
exactly. A silver lining, maybe.
So there's one thing I was really curious about, just on a personal note, as somebody who has been heavily involved in theater, your production of Madness in Valencia. There was one scene that you described as nightmarish and extremely challenging to direct because there were so many moving parts in a small space.
Yeah.
Everyone was getting increasingly frustrated, including you, until you went out and went for a walk. And then you had an idea and you came back and knew how to fix it. I'm just really curious, what was your solution? And did that kind of help you with future problem scenes?
Completely. Yeah. And I can't remember exactly what the solution was, but it was the final scene in Madness in Valencia where, yes, we were back in this pub theater, which is not a big space. And I think we had a cast of like 12 people. The play ends in a sort of Shakespearean way with lots of people pretending to be other people. And there's a lot of unmasking. And I'm actually this person. And oh my God, then I love you and all this sort of stuff. And it was just, how do we do this in a way that the audience is clear on what the story is at all points? And I can't remember what the solution is, but I do remember that I went for a walk and came back and went, oh, I know what it is we need to do. But it's been, I mean, that
was a long time ago.
A long time ago now. Yeah, nearly 20 years. Ugh. But it's like the same thing happened in Cyrano that I just did. Like there's a bit that was really scrunchy and you go, I just don't know what that is yet. And you're sort of in the room trying different things. But I find that if I'm trying something, if I'm in the room and it's not working, the things that my brain tends to offer up then tend to be like small solutions. Like it might be maybe that person needs to move a bit, or maybe we just need that to be a bit faster, or maybe they need to hit that word a bit more. And I'm not able when I'm in the room to sort of take a big old step back from it. And I find if I go for a walk or get a bit of space, and I've learned to trust the people around me that I'm able to say to people, I know that this isn't working now and I don't know how to fix it now. So I'm going to go away and then tomorrow we'll come back in and I'll see what we've got there. And invariably I come in the next day and in the shower or on a run or cycling in, something pops into your head and you go, oh, it doesn't happen when you're staring right at it.
Right.
But then suddenly your brain goes, what if something quite considerably different? What if that scene doesn't go there, it goes here in the dramaturgy of the whole thing? Or what if you cut that bit out completely and put it here? You come back in with a much bigger rethink of it. And sometimes that doesn't work either. But the more you try those things out, the bigger swings, the more specific you can become about what isn't working. And sometimes that's the helpful thing. Like I trust my own taste enough now to watch a bit of a play, certainly, and go, that's not working, but I couldn't necessarily tell you why yet. But the more I try different things, the closer I get to, oh, I've worked out what it is that's not working. And then I can fix it.
Oh, that's very cool.
It's really cool. I'm so lucky.
Before we head out, is there anything that you're working on now? I mean, you just did Cyrano.
I'm writing a novel and I'm writing the pilot for a couple of TV shows. And we're hoping that Cyrano will have a future life. So All of those things are sort of bubbling away.
Well, I'm excited to see what you do next, especially in film or television, so that we can enjoy it around the world. I'd love to maybe see a movie or series about magic from you, but whatever it is, I will definitely be watching.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Simon. I appreciate you taking the time to do this and wish you the best of luck with your upcoming projects.
Not at all. And thank you for being so kind about everything.
Simon's fantastic series Stage can be seen on any number of streaming platforms worldwide, which I've linked to in the description. If you haven't seen it yet, definitely give it a watch, especially if you're in need of a laugh. His wonderful production of Cyrano is also running in Stratford-upon-Avon until mid-November, so if you're in the area or planning to visit that part of the UK, check it out as well. And you can get an idea of some of the other shows he's done from the links I've included below. So keep an eye out for his future work, and thank you so much for listening to The Art of Imagination. I know there are a lot of podcasts out there, and I appreciate every person who chooses to tune in for this one. So thank you again, and I hope you'll join us next time.